Operation Epic Fury, the U.S.-led action in Iran, enters its third week as President Trump says the end is near. What happens next, and will the Iranian people gain freedom from Islamist rule? Dr. Waleed Fares and Ghazal Shammad are here with analysis. China-U.S. trade talks got underway this week. What do these talks hope to achieve, and how has China exerted its influence in the Iran war? Foreign policy expert Gordon Chang is here with an update. More and more U.S. parents are saying they regret having children, and young adults are going no contact with their parents. What do these disturbing trends mean? Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Noelle Mehring, shares her perspective. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year this month. We've got an important show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Operation Epic Fury, the U.S.-Israeli campaign against Iran, enters its third week. Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei is dead. Killed in the opening salvos on February 28th. His son, Mashtaba, has been named his successor. And yet, the Islamic Republic fights on. Seven Americans are confirmed dead in action, and nearly 140 more have been wounded. Oil spiked past $100 a barrel as Iranian action in the Strait of Hormuz chokes the world's energy supply. Where's all this going? With analysis, I'm joined by Middle East policy analyst Dr. Waleed Fares and human rights advocate Ghazal Shammad, both co-hosts of the War and Freedom podcast. Waleed, the Pentagon says Iran's missile capacity has been degraded by 90%. We've struck over 5,000 targets. And yet the new supreme leader has been installed and the IRGC has pledged loyalty and Iran's still fighting. President Trump said this week the war has already been won.
And as we take decisive action to stop the threat posed by the terrorist regime in Iran with Operation Epic Fury, let me say, we've won. You know, you never like to say too early you won. We won. We won the bet. In the first hour, it was over. We don't want to leave early, do we, huh? We got to finish the job, right? Over the past 11 days, our military has virtually destroyed Iran.
Waleed, what does the president mean by we've won? And is that a realistic assessment?
Well, what he means we can translate into history. We are now on the ground in 1944 in the Ardennes. So we actually landed. We actually pushed the German forces or the Nazi forces, and we are about to enter. Since we are not deploying forces on the ground, what the president means is that the Navy, the regime Navy is gone. The Air Force is gone, most of it at least. Number of leaders are gone. The, the supreme leader is gone. Now you have his son. That's another story. And obviously what is important is that all or most of these missiles are gone. So when the president says we have won militarily, he means that there need to be a closing. And in my view, the closing will only happen if you have a force of Iranians on the ground. They will be the ones to go to these missiles, to these factories, to shut down everything, even to transfer the material we are concerned about. That has not happened for one reason. We have not engaged with the transition. We have not engaged with the government on the ground that could help us yet.
The Atlantic Council's analysis and others are warning this is different from the 12-day war last June. That Iran sees this as existential. They're not looking for an off-ramp. They're calculating that the war of attrition works in their favor. Waleed, does the administration have a plan for that scenario?
We know that they have a plan to disarm the strategic weapons of the regime from the air. That's what we're seeing. And of course, in the sea, the Hormuz passage, all of that is under control and will be under control. The plan that we don't see is how we're going to, at the end of the day, arm the opposition. We know that few groups here and there, Kurds, you know, Baluch, others, they have weapons. Not enough to counter the presence and the next offensive to be led by the IRGC and the Basij. There are about 300,000-400,000 who will actually fight. So we are now pressed by time to make sure that we have the transition, which I mentioned about, and that transition should have forces on the ground. So we are behind in terms of having allies on the ground. We are ahead in terms of destroying the military power of this regime.
Ghazal, you've been watching this regime operate up close for 5 years now, ever since they kidnapped your father in Dubai. When you heard President Trump say the war would end very soon, what was your reaction to that? And is that a realistic appraisal?
It is realistic, and that's what we're hoping for if we take the right steps. As Dr. Faris was just saying, we have dismantled the military capacity of the regime to strike back through missiles and other means. What is important is if America doesn't want troops on the ground, and that's what we don't want, the people of Iran have to be able to mobilize and take over the institutions, as the president has said. This is only possible if we have mass deflections from the armed forces to the nation, and if we have participation of millions of people. The same scenario that we saw pretty much in January, the uprising in January was in 31 provinces. Millions came to the streets. Millions were ready to take over the institutions, but they were brutally repressed by the repressive apparatus of the Islamic regime, which is the IRGC forces and the besieged bases. So what we're seeing right now, which is wonderful, is attacks on the besieged bases, on the IRGC forces. These are the ones that are holding the Iranians back, that are shooting into civilian masses, that have massacred thousands of Iranians in January. So that is a good step. The next step that has to happen, as Dr. Faris mentioned already, the cooperation with the transitional leadership under Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi has already 50,000 deflections from the army registered, has already shown that they have the capability of mobilizing masses into the streets. So this cooperation will save us time and will make sure that this mission is successful in the end.
Okay, but Ghazal, why aren't we seeing, though, the mass protests and the demonstrations in the street that we were seeing just a few weeks ago? Or is it just not being covered?
Both the president and the prime minister of Israel, as well as the transitional government under the crown prince, have told the people that it is not safe at this time to come to the streets. Yeah. So they should stay in their homes. That's what they're doing. And they're mobilizing and preparing for the next phase when it is safe and when it is organized together with the transitional leadership to come to the streets. So this is just a phase where they have to sit it out, prepare, make sure they're safe, because it's not just war and bombs falling from the sky. The Islamic regime, we have seen over and over again in the last weeks, has declared war on the people, has said if anybody comes to the street, they will be treated like military. They will be treated like the IDF, like the American military. They will be shot against. They will be killed. So they have declared war on the people right now instead of continuing the war with the military forces that are outside. So this regime is scared of the population of Iran. So we have to make sure that we're working together with them to make sure that this regime is finally finished.
Waleed, the new supreme leader issued his first statement. We haven't seen him, but he's issuing his first statement, vowing to continue to attack Iran's neighbors, shutting down the Strait of Hormuz as leverage against the U.S. and Israel. Will that work?
They are off balance. I mean, the IRGC, the Basij, but the core of the leadership, which is now putting that new Khamenei in some bunker because they're afraid that if he's killed, then many things are going to start to collapse. What's happening is that this regime is using Khamenei II as long as they can to keep unity inside the regime, to keep them in check, because many officers, as Ghazal said, and soldiers have expressed their intention to break away and join the opposition. The opposition doesn't have a system to receive them. And by the way, I'd like to make a note on what you have asked about, which regard why would the population not go now? First of all, again, as Ghazal said, it is because they were told by the president and by their leaders. But second, yesterday, something new happened, talking about it for the first time. The allies, U.S. and Israel, launched hundreds, maybe thousands of those small drones over Tehran throughout the night. And what did they do? They targeted the checkpoints, the security checkpoints of the besieged, and they were killing them. So days after that, what we're going to see is that the presence of the regime may start to shrink. If they don't have checkpoints, if they don't have these units, that's what actually we have suggested days ago. That would be a moment, would be decided by the U.S. for the population to go out.
Ghazal, do you believe that the new Ayatollah is fully functioning?
We don't even know if he's alive. I mean, they brought a cardboard a picture of him to the inauguration. And that's like he might as well not be there. What Dr. Farah said is it's just symbolically to have somebody that they can tell the armies, that they can tell the IRGC, this is where the command center is. This is, we're still unified. We're still united. There's still a chance. So this is more posturing than anything else. Even if he was alive, there was always a competition between these factions of the Islamic regime to take each other out and assume the leadership role. But the leadership role is right now a targeted role, so they're not willing to have anybody in that position.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's the bullseye on your face role. Nobody wants it. Waleed, I want to turn to oil and energy for a moment. WTI crude topped $100 a barrel earlier this week, first time since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Gas prices are up to 70 cents a gallon, up 70 cents a gallon since January. The Strait of Hormuz, as we talked about, 20% of the world's oil flows through there. That's been effectively closed. Iran's been laying mines. U.S. forces have sunk 16 Iranian mine layers. The IEA has authorized an unprecedented 400 million barrel emergency reserve release. And still, the administration is saying, hold on, this is a small price to pay. Is it a small price to pay? And how long do you think Americans will absorb this?
Proportionally, yes, it is a price that we need to pay to get through the tunnel. If we don't pay it now, and I'll explain how it is not really what people think, we're going to pay double and triple. If this regime goes back to what it was before, forget about the control of oil in the Middle East. The people are, in those instances, these companies are living the trauma of the Iran/Iraq war, where indeed there was a complete paralysis of the Persian Gulf. What's happening now is that these are the last days where the regime can still interfere, because once their marine, their navy is gone, once those little dinghies, you know, who come like swarms against the ships are gone, then the price of oil is going to go down. One more thing, though, I must say, we don't know when the regime in Tehran is going to ask the Houthis to do the same on the other side of the Red Sea. That is something we have to expect. But at the end of the day, the regime goes down, oil will be much better.
Ghazal, your father's case showed the world what Iran does to its enemies abroad. Kidnapping in Dubai, we've seen assassination plots in Maryland and Canada. A boxing gym in Toronto was shot up the night Khomeini was killed. The Austin shooting the morning after the strikes began. And then there was those two teenagers who declared allegiance to ISIS, arrested in New York after attempting to detonate a bomb at a protest. What is the threat level for Iranians and Iranian Americans living here in the U.S.?
It's huge. If you remember, the Islamic regime in 2009 sent assassins to our door here in Los Angeles to murder our family. And then when they couldn't do that, when that was foiled by the FBI, kidnapped my father overseas, took him to Iran, tortured and murdered him and mutilated his body. So they mean business. We have just yesterday, I think, received so many warnings from the FBI that there might be threats, terrorist attacks on California, throughout the border, drone strikes from IRGC cells that are across the border, sleeper cells within our communities here in America. So we know that our government is not warning us for nothing. They're warning us because they're here and they're trying to alert the public to this. We're all citizens that have to be alerted to a threat on our lives. So it's not just Iranian Americans. It's the greater American public that is under threat. And we have to understand these threats will not go away if this regime survives. They will become bigger, stronger, continue until they reach what they want to reach, and which is a complete takeover of America. And we've already seen that in so many pockets throughout our country, what these Islamists are doing. We saw that in the Middle East. The Middle East shows what they did to Iran, but they did so many to many civilized nations throughout the whole country, throughout the whole Middle East. They want to do the same in America, and that is why the outcome of this military intervention has to lead to the liberation of Iran, because Iran was the closest and natural ally of the West, of America, for so many years.
Waleed, U.S. intelligence has intercepted what appear to be shortwave radio transmissions, believed to be activation signals to sleeper cells. How serious is that threat? How many of these cells do you think are potentially here? And have these Islamists pre-positioned operators in the United States?
We have, now let's inform the public, sure. We have two types of threats. One is those sleeper cells, sleeper, half sleeper, we don't know, because some of them are active even, you know, during the in-between of the crisis. And many of them came also through the border. Thank God we have a Trump administration, which as of last year shut down the border, but many have already been inside. Those sleeper cells may be responsible for some of the incidents that we see. And I see that those incidents are, you know, growing in numbers. That's one. But then you have a standing army, urban army. They globalize the Intifada people. What, you know, those could be weaponized as well. And those are very large in numbers, from New York to San Francisco. So our DHS, FBI, and all the agencies, and including the sheriffs locally, they need to pay attention to all of these threats. One is infiltrators, numbers, we don't know. It could be in the hundreds, or even the urban Intifada, which basically calls itself the globalized Intifada movement. We have to be very attentive.
Gazelle, exiled Iranian Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, who we've talked about earlier, the idea is that he will fill this this leadership void between the fall of the Khomeinis and the mullahs and whatever comes next. This week, he called on the Iranian people to prepare, continue to strike from work, and wait for his final call. What is the plan here? I know they're calling this the emergency phase. What does that mean?
That means in the end, there is a cooperation between America, Israel, and the Iranian people to make sure that Iran goes back to what it was, a prosperous, democratic country and an ally of the West, an ally of all of the civilization. This cannot happen without the help of the Iranian people. If we look at history, no revolution has ever been successful with two things in place. One, mass deflections from the army. They have to deflect to some authority. Second, a clear authority in place that will take on the sovereignty, that will give orders, that will make sure there is no chaos, there is no civil war, there is no such scenario as we saw in Libya or in Syria or in other places. So to make that possible, we need the leadership. And we are lucky that we already established one. The Crown Prince is not just the son of the Shah. He is the transitional leadership that has combined the widest coalition of opposition forces from left to right, from any faction, from any part of Iran, has been combined under this leadership, and they're cooperating with them. That's why we saw such massive uprisings in January that were able to threaten this regime in such an extent that they had to bring in Hashd militias and other militias from outside of the country to commit a genocide against the Iranian people. So that is his role. And then there's another detailed plan for the first 180 days after the fall of the regime, how to stabilize the country with the goal to bring the Iranian people to the ballot box where they can determine their future, they can determine their leadership, they can determine, it's about self-determination of a nation that has been occupied by these Arab Islamists for 47 years.
Waleed, Pahlavi says he doesn't want bloodshed on the streets. With all due respect, how else do you have a revolution?
Well, he will have to say that's for international law. There's going to be an international tribunal that will come after the war. And Nuremberg is going to be established. He want to make sure that he says, I tried in every way I can. I'm a peaceful man. I'm not ordering my people to killing innocent civilians, versus statement coming from the regime. I mean, so many statements saying, kill them all if they are responsible or not responsible. So one time historically, we're going to see the difference between how he leads his population or the entire opposition and how the regime does that.
Yeah. In January of 2026, as we've been talking about, the Iranian people did rise up in what may have been the largest protest since the 1979 revolution. The regime responded with massacres, I mean, there could be as many as from 3,000 to 32,000 people just slaughtered, according to Iranian health officials. Ghazal, when you see Iranians rising up, when you see members of Iran's women's soccer team defecting to Australia in the middle of this war, what do you believe the Iranian people want? And what happens if the current regime is deposed, but Islamic rule of some type returns?
We talked about that last time, Raymond, as we're trying to compare what happened in 1979 inside of Iran to the Islamization of America. So the Iranian people are a free people. They are they believe in freedom. Our founding fathers of America, Thomas Jefferson, looked actually at the Iranian model of Cyrus the Great, the founder of a big empire, to model our constitution, to create the state system that we have right now in the United States. So our people in Iran are very similar, same patriotic, same freedom-loving people as they are in America, but they have been under occupation. So the reaction of the people naturally is to fight with everything that they have against this occupation and reestablish rule under Iranian principles, Iranian values, which are the values of the West, which are the values of civilization. So they are willing to give life and limb and anything, as you see, even with soccer players who are outside of Iran and defying this regime here. Over here, they don't want any kind of oppression, Islamization, or anything that is foreign to Iran.
Mm-hmm. Waleed, we opened with this about all the attacks on Tehran. You talked about the munitions and the bits of their military that really have been decimated. The question is, they still have some munitions and weapons because their terror is continuing in the neighboring states. What do they have within reach, and how long do you think they'll have it?
That is very comparable to the situation after Kuwait, where Saddam Hussein lost his air force, his little navy, many things, and yet survived with an army capable of massacring both Shia and Kurds. If you remember that time, it took another action by the air forces of the coalition then in Iraq to destroy his machinery, his death machinery. But with regard to Iran today, the difference is that there are forces inside Iran in multiple places who are ready to move. There are forces politically in the diaspora. This is one of the most dynamic diasporas, you know, comparable to the Jewish diaspora. So all these are in place. What needs to be done, I don't want to be repeating more and more, but we need to have allies inside the country. Like De Gaulle was in exile, he formed a government, but the Force Française Libre, the Free French Forces, were all over, the resistance was all over France. So when the Nazis were destroyed, it was simple. The French free government took over little by little. And in 9 months, France came back in 1945 to what it was in 1939, and even better. So we need to have this imagination that the 9/11 commissioners told us to have. Move forward, but have this imagination that would allow you to get to your goal as soon as possible.
One more question. With the Crown Prince assuming leadership here, or about to, people I've talked to have said, look, this is concerning because of the population in Iran. I mean, you still have a Muslim bloc, a substantial Muslim population there, right?
We actually don't, Raymond. One of the last studies that was done is a Gaman study by Norway showed that the Muslim population inside of Iran is actually a minority. They make up maybe 30% of the entire population. And even those Muslims, there's a difference between Muslims and Islamists. That's why the Islamic regime has to have the besieged forces, yep, Islamist forces with machine guns to hold down even the secular Muslim population in there. So Iran, by definition, has always been a non-Islamist country. The Ayatollahs are as foreign to Iran as they are to America. In fact, the Ayatollahs trace their ancestry back to the first Arab Islamist that came 1,400 years ago and took over the entire Middle East, occupied Spain, which is a Christian country, for 800 years. People tend to forget that. The Spanish population didn't change, you know, under 800 years. So is the same with the Iranian population. We have Christian Christian churches, underground Kurdish churches. We had the biggest Jewish community inside of Iran, inside of the Middle East, outside of Israel. They wiped them out. So you can understand that there's a big makeup that is not Islamic inside of the country, but held back by machine guns and by force. So liberating them from that force will show you the true nature of the Iranian people, which are not Islamists.
And Raymond, one quick thing.
Waleed, you wanted to say what?
There will be a quick change. I mean, the big difference is going to be not just the past, but the future. You control the educational system. You have the classrooms. In 5 to 7 years, all jihadism and Islamism will be gone by a new government.
Waleed Ghazal, we will leave it there. And you can catch the War and Freedom podcast at War Freedom on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Whatever is happening in the world right now, the war in Iran, the turmoil in Latin America and Cuba, if you follow the thread far enough, there's usually a connection to Beijing. How has China been exerting its influence in all of these spheres without being explicitly involved? Joining me to discuss, senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute and foreign policy expert Gordon Chang. Gordon, thanks for being here. You have called China, not Iran, an enemy combatant in the U.S.-Israeli-Iran conflict. Why?
China has been providing all-in support, everything other than combat troops. I mean, first of all, they elevated commodity purchases. Last year, China took 87.2% of Iran's exports of crude oil, according to one estimate. Year in, year out, it's about 90%. But there's diplomatic support, propaganda support, and weapons support. So, for instance, Iran and all three of its proxies, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthi militia, they all have large quantities of Chinese weapons. You scrape open any sort of Iran weapon with a microchip, that microchip almost certainly came from China, or it was sourced for Iran through Chinese intermediaries. And Iran's nuclear weapons program, that was essentially transplanted from China. The list goes on and on. But you can see that Beijing has been supporting Iran, and Iran would not be able to have caused the disruptions in the world over the last 3 years were it not for Beijing.
You've written that Iran has essentially been doing China's foreign policy work for quite some time, with Beijing's Middle East strategy run through Tehran. Now that Iran has been significantly weakened, at least that's what we're hearing, what does China's strategic map look like in the region? And who fills the vacuum, Gordon?
China has essentially been forced out of the region, Raymond. If we go back a couple of years, China looked dominant. For instance, in March of 2023, it brokered the deal between Riyadh and Tehran, resuming diplomatic relations. July 2024, you had the Beijing declarations when the heads of 14 Palestinian factions went to the Chinese capital to sign that unity pact. But then President Trump came in. He had that triumphant tour through the Gulf in May of last year. And now with Iran being taken off the board, China really no longer has the inroads that it had in the region.
Gordon, if the United States and Israel prevail and there's some kind of new government in Tehran, does China move in to try to shape the post-war order, like financing the rebuild? And is the U.S. prepared to counter that?
China has always tried to make contacts with new governments, even after it's lost friendly ones. And yes, they will be there, but President Trump is probably going to block them because he understands what's at stake. So we're not going to make the same mistakes that we have made in other places by going to war and then allowing the Chinese to come in. We did that in Iraq. We did that in Afghanistan. And I'm sure we're not going to do it in Iran.
You've described and chronicled China's penetration of our own hemisphere as something close to an encirclement strategy. With Maduro now in a New York detention facility, how much has China's position in Venezuela been set back? I know they stockpiled a lot of oil earlier this year. The New York Times had a piece on this. But with Iran and Venezuela now off the scene, what's the impact for China?
Well, China is losing its proxies. And the bigger impact is that if you go back to last year and for about 5 years before that, Xi Jinping was peddling the narrative that the United States was in terminal decline and that China was going to run the world. Now, that narrative is ludicrous. And even in Beijing, where Xi Jinping holds great sway, people are starting to question that. So the main point for Xi Jinping is that he has sort of lost the cue cards. That's important because China was intimidating a lot of countries into doing things because he was making that argument that they're going to have to deal with him. And matter of fact, even Trump was somewhat intimidated by Xi Jinping last year. I don't think Trump is intimidated by Xi this year at all.
What is China doing here in America that we're simply ignoring, Gordon? I mean, we hear a lot about the fentanyl debate, the cartels, the border, but you hear very little about who's actually running the supply chain at the top.
Well, China is infiltrated American society from the top to the bottom. But they've one thing that I focus on are their agents, their network of operatives and soldiers. You know, on January 31, Las Vegas SWAT and federal agents descended on that home in Las Vegas, which was essentially a Chinese biological weapons storage facility. They found more than 1,000 vials of a reddish substance that was making people extremely ill. This came after December 2022, when authorities found a Chinese biological weapons facility in Reedley, California, that had at least 20 pathogens, many of them for deadly diseases, and more and almost 1,000 mice that have been genetically engineered to spread disease. So the Chinese are planning a mass casualty event from American soil to kill Americans. It's as simple as that, and we're not talking about it.
The Senate has been examining something that one witness, Gordon, described as an industrial model. Over 1,000 Chinese companies specifically set up to get children born on American soil, using our 14th Amendment to create so-called anchor babies. FBI agents raided an apartment in Arcadia, California, and they found 21 infants. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court's preparing to hear arguments on birthright citizenship. How serious a national security threat is this, and how long has it been going on, in your estimation?
It's been going on for a long time. Now, a lot of Chinese people come to the United States because they want to live in a free society. And matter of fact, they are more loyal Americans than many native-born Americans. But the Communist Party has taken advantage of the 14th Amendment, and they've had this program for quite some time. We don't know the full numbers of it. Peter Schweitzer has written about this. This is really important because it shows one thing. Even if there are not that many anchor babies under this Communist Party program, the point is China uses every point of contact to take down our society. And we have got to eliminate those points of contact because right now, Raymond, we're being overwhelmed. We don't understand what's going on. And until we do, and until we can wrap our hands around it, we need to eliminate these Communist Party contacts with us.
There's also the surrogacy angle. I mean, a Chinese national hires a surrogate, the baby's born here, and that child holds an American passport. Now, under Article 7 of China's national intelligence law, every Chinese citizen, including their children, is legally obligated to cooperate with Chinese intelligence. What are you hearing about the way that China has manufactured a class of compromised American citizens? And what do you say to people who say that's alarmist?
The facts are the facts, and Peter Schweitzer has put those out in public. And if they want to dispute that, that's fine. But it's clear what the Communist Party is doing with this surrogacy, because they're taking those babies, bringing them back to China, indoctrinating them, and then having them come back here, where, of course, they have the right to vote. And they have citizenship, which really can't be taken away from them. So we know what they're doing. And if people want to dispute it, then they're going to have that conversation. But these are facts.
Gordon, does Xi Jinping look at the United States right now, stretched militarily, depleted of smart munitions, distracted by Iran? Do they see a window, the Chinese, for Taiwan? And what is China's combat readiness right now?
I think the Chinese would love to see that window, but they don't really have it. And they don't have it because the Chinese military is not prepared. Xi Jinping has engaged in more than a decade of purges of senior military officers. And that purge has actually intensified over the last 2.5 years, and especially over the last several months. So for instance, at the top of the Chinese military, which is the Communist Party's Central Military Commission, normally has 7 members. Now it has only 2. It has Xi Jinping and it has a political commissar. There are no operational officers on the Central Military Commission. So they can't launch an invasion of the main island of Taiwan because that's a combined air, land, sea operation. And it's exceedingly complex for any military, especially for China's military, mm-hmm. which has never done it in its history. So right now, yeah, they see an opportunity, but they can't take advantage of it.
This week, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and the Chinese vice premier are meeting in Paris. This is the 6th round of trade negotiations, which is laying the groundwork for the Trump-Xi summit in Beijing at the end of the month. Now, Gordon, is genuine productive dialogue with the Chinese Communist Party actually possible? And what should be the non-negotiables on which the U.S. needs to insist?
The answer to your first question is no, it is not possible. Remember, this is a militant communist state that seeks the destruction of the United States and which through fentanyl and COVID has killed more than 1 million Americans, probably about 2 million, a deliberate policy of mass murder. So how can we talk to these people? But if you want to say, well, we got to get along with them, we'll talk trade. Well, in January 2020, we had the phase one trade deal. China had some very clear commitments, easy to honor, and they didn't. So why are we talking to people, you know, who have no intention of fulfilling their promises to us? We just need to impose costs. The Chinese are just delaying us. And, you know, I don't blame them for taking advantage of us because we are purposefully not doing, we're not understanding what's going on. And we have allowed them to take advantage of us. So, of course, they're doing that.
Yeah, they're playing along. They're kind of rope-a-doping the administration, which they've done administration after administration. Let's sit down. We'll have fanfare. We'll all dance and have, you know, entertainment. And then nothing gets honored. They come up with these agreements that are like burned the minute they're signed. Before we run out of time, 78-year-old Catholic Hong Kong businessman, we've talked about him before, Gordon, and we've covered his case extensively on the world over, Jimmy Lai, remains in prison after being sentenced to 20 years for basically the crime of journalism and free expression. His legal team has confirmed they will not appeal. The UK Foreign Secretary has called for his release on humanitarian grounds. You followed this case closely. Does the decision not to appeal actually open a narrow door for Jimmy's release? I know there was some report that he was going to be released, but I'm not sure of the whether that's verified or not. It looks fishy to me.
Yeah, regardless of what the British do, I think the Chinese will release Jimmy. And the reason is that he's already a martyr. They don't want to make him more of a martyr by having him die in prison. I don't know the origin of those reports, but I do believe that they are credible because it aligns with what I think the Chinese want to do. So I hope that President Trump exerts every, you know, uses every element of power to free Jimmy. But I think it will happen, Raymond.
Really? Well, let's pray for that. That's fantastic. What is the strategy there then? What do you think the Chinese get out of it? Just they kind of get him off the scene and the world stops talking about him? Is that the strategy?
That's part of it. And the other part is that he's doesn't become the martyr that he is, that he will become if he dies in prison. He's 78 years old. He is in very poor health. And they just don't want him to be on, you know, they don't want him around. So, and also they will look great if they said, well, we're going to, on humanitarian grounds, release you, Jimmy. So Beijing thinks that it can get something from it. So whatever it is, we need to free Jimmy. And we need to send a message to the Chinese people by freeing Jimmy that the American, that we Americans support freedom in China.
Amen. Gordon Chang, as always, thank you for being here. Thank you for your analysis.
Thank you, Raymond, and God bless.
Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast this week, I sat down with parish priest and chief exorcist of the Diocese of Nashville, Father Dan Rehill. Now, it's a sobering conversation about the rise of exorcisms and why the right is taking so long to take effect these days, and the hidden nature of evil in the modern world. The need for exorcism is on the rise. What's happening here? You see it, there's a lot of reportage that your services are needed now more than ever. Why?
Well, I think it's a few factors. One is that this generation, there is a rising up of young people going back to church suddenly in the last, I mean, since Charlie Kirk for sure, but before that. But there's also this, the mask is off with the evil, and there's a lot of people leaving God and the church, all church, behind. And the new age is booming. You know, the witchcraft is booming. It's mainstream. You can buy witchcraft products in stores on Broadway. That was never the case. The other big thing was COVID. During COVID, every exorcist will tell you the cases skyrocketed. And you'd be like, well, that's so unusual. Why?
They were alone.
Why? We took away the sacraments.
Oh.
We took away the sacraments. And then we gave people money and told them to go do whatever they want.
Self-medicate.
And everything went off the rails. And it really hasn't come back to the point before COVID. Things are harder. The cases take longer. So a case which would have taken 2, 3, 4 times is now taking maybe 6, 10, 12 months. And they're piling up with new cases coming in. So it is getting worse.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Father Dan Rehill is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and it's free. I also had a great conversation with John Cooper, the frontman for the rock band Skillet, about his faith and family and how they really undergird and have driven the success of his band. And of course, Friday, a new Prayerful Posse, where we talk about the Vatican and the U.S. bishops reacting to the war in Iran and what happened to church teaching on just war. Go to Arroyo Grande Show wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. There's a troubling theme running through American culture right now. Adults walking away from the very things that once defined what it meant to be fully human. Marriage, children, family. There's a growing movement of young adults who've cut off contact with their own parents over ideology. What's happening to us? To help us make sense of this all, I'm joined by author and fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Noel Mehring. Noel, thank you for being here. New York Magazine ran a piece this month, and it was first-person accounts from young mothers who described regretting having their children. One of them, a 34-year-old, says, I'm going to read directly from this, thinking about life without them, I'd be happier overall, end quote. Another says she wished she'd lived alone in an isolated life, but a peaceful one. Noelle, what do you make of this? What's happening? And is this reflective of reality, or is it the New York Magazine trying to create one?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, I think we've gone from childless by choice, you know, brunch and travel as the new aspirational lifestyle, to child regret. And this new movement is a little starker because there's children already involved and the horrifying prospect of them actually hearing that their moms regretted having them or even just sensing it in the way that they're being raised. So it's a darker turn, but I think in some ways it's a predictable one. Let me explain why. There's a few stages of progression when we are destabilizing a norm. The first stage, you destigmatize the deviation from the norm. You say, you know, we're going to be childless. We decided we don't want children. And don't call us selfish, this is just our choice. Secondly, you normalize that deviation. So it just becomes entirely optional. You can get married and then you can choose to have children, you can choose to actively prevent children forever. It's just entire option to you, up to you, and there's not really a norm involved. And then thirdly, inversion. The norm itself becomes cast as a source of oppression, sort of a darker choice, something that hinders your freedom, liberty, and then the rejection of it becomes an act of courage, an act of liberation. Now, it's interesting because in some ways I read this article with some sympathy. Parenting is incredibly difficult. And I think we can acknowledge that as we're a more mobile society, we have less of a safety network. We don't have parents and oftentimes grandparents, cousins, and aunts and uncles to help us. It's also incredibly hard for anyone, but it's incredibly much more made much more difficult if we no longer see it as a social good, a necessity. that if we start seeing it as being something that is sort of devalued in our minds, it becomes very difficult to endure the sort of the sacrificial acts that are required by parenting when you don't see the why behind it. It's not that we don't know how to suffer. It's just that we've chosen to suffer for other things.
Yeah. And Noelle, these aren't women in this New York magazine piece. These women don't. It's not that they don't love their children. They say they do. But there's a real disconnect between loving someone and experiencing their existence as a burden. What does that tell us about how our culture has sold young women the idea of motherhood?
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I think that it has recast motherhood as being something that's deeply antagonistic to their well-being and their flourishing. It's really the exact opposite of what motherhood is. And so they're given sort of things to be attracted to in life, such as a high-end career that they're willing to suffer for, or even beauty. You know, we see plastic surgery and also, you know, intense exercise regimes that women are willing to endure for. And they're not putting that endurance into the family life. And I think there's a real spiritual nihilism underlying this. So one of the things I hear a lot in researching my next book, the No Contact Movement, is adult children saying, I didn't consent to be born. You chose to have me, so you owe me, I don't owe you. And the underlying message there is that my life is not a blessing, it's a burden. And so if the act of parenting is no longer generous, you're not giving something good to this person, you're actually burdening them with their own life, then why would anyone move into that category of parenthood? So there's a real connection to the birth starts here.
Yeah, well, look, as somebody who's on the far side of this with grown kids, I can't fathom any of this. I mean, I would argue for men and women, marriage and children reveal your purpose. I mean, it's in them that I certainly discovered my reason for being. My wife sacrificed her career for our kids, but they're all healthy, they're happy, they're productive people due to that sacrifice, frankly. And I don't see how there could be anything more precious or valuable. I mean, the car's going to rot, the career's going to go away, your looks are going to age. Your children, your family, that goes on and on.
That's right. It's really hard to unwire this kind of desire and this intuitive need to love the child in front of us, to want to be fruitful, to want to be in unity with our family. To get women to be convinced to walk away from all of that, either by never entering into it or by abandoning it altogether, it takes a whole host of sort of propaganda and coercion and manipulation. Unfortunately, we've had that for decades. They've been very patient. The ideologues have been in seeding revolutionary mindset into all of us. And I think we should be just as confident that we have truths about human nature and we can seed the real vision of what a good life is and the real flourishing of the human person in order to kind of dismantle this kind of mountain of ideology that has been thrust upon us.
You wrote a recent piece, which I want to explore later, where you write, a purely comfortable life is eventually perceived as a meaningless one. Now, it strikes me that these young women are experiencing the inverse, a deeply uncomfortable life that also feels meaningless. So where does meaning break down, Noelle? And is there something the church can say to a woman currently in that place?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's complicated because oftentimes, you know, there are real wounds underlying this. The way that someone is disposed to accept ideology is because they are wounded. And what the ideology steps in to do is to help them double down on that wound and to give an explanatory cause for it and sort of a culprit. And we've also at the same time incentivized us to find our virtue in our victimhood. And I think that's a deeply toxic way to build a culture. Why? Because in order to maintain a status of victimhood, I have to maintain a position of accusation. I have to always have a perpetrator. And so I think we've kind of jumped on sort of real wounds in society and then encouraged people to kind of rub raw the sores of discontent with anger, with discontent, with rage. And that serves well sort of an ideology that wants to break things down and blow things up. It doesn't serve well to get people to move to a place of real deep meaning where they can aspire to a life that is going to be rich and really in line with our human nature. So I think the church really is at the perfect position to kind of offer exactly what are the deepest longings in our hearts and souls. We have to speak about it unapologetically, but with a lot of great love, and sort of show the way towards beauty, show the way towards the good life through elevating stories of heroic people, not just trying to criticize, you know, the wrongs in this world, but elevating the beautiful ways in which we can live. I think the church is properly positioned to do that. And it seems like there's a real hunger out there. We're seeing a lot of people seeking meaning, seeking authority, seeking something that takes them out of sort of the mundane, prosaic world that we live in, wanting that transcendence. And so how much more we can lean into that and really encourage, deepen, and direct what's happening in people, I think is going to be for our benefit and for the culture's benefit.
Another disturbing trend that we're seeing, Noelle, recently is one you've also written about in The Federalist. It's called cutting off your parents is identity politics, not boundaries. And you argue there that the no contact movement follows the same grammar as identity politics. Virtue signaling, victim classes, moral absolutism, an adversarial caste in every relationship. Where did this come from? This idea that you could just cut people off.
It seems like it's the logic of a very online generation applied to the real life relationships, where they're used to curating their reality. When things get hard, you can mute someone, you can block someone, you can unfollow someone. Well, you're applying that ethic into your real relationships, and that does not translate well for anyone, people on the either side of either being cut off or the one doing the cutting off. So I think it's the newest manifestation of attacking the family unit. And I do think, you know, the way that it's talked about in these subcultures of the no contact movement, it really mirrors identity politics. So it will say there's a group that's in the power position, and that's the parents. They've got the power. And then there's the group that, you know, didn't consent to their life, didn't consent to their birth, and they are in the victim position. And so the duty flows one way. It flows from the parents to the child, and the child owes nothing, even in adulthood, owes no allegiance or honor to the parents. It's, of course, an inversion of the fourth commandment. And one of the saddest parts about it is that it's leaving a lot of young adults very vulnerable to sort of the inevitable crises of their life. They don't have that family support. One of the things that they're doing to step in and to kind of put a band-aid over that is that they've erected this idea of the chosen family, that the family that I choose is born of my autonomy. Now, that can be a beautiful thing. Sometimes we need our friends to become like family. But when we're using it to replace the family, that's not a very stable way of moving through the world. And oftentimes what they find is that the family that they choose can just as easily unchoose them. And so they're being abandoned again after already abandoning the family of their origin. So this is a real crisis, and we're seeing it being given more attention increasingly in mainstream press, and for good reason, because it is taking on a new tenor and a new escalation that we've not seen before.
Isn't there something almost totalitarian about this? I mean, the adult child who cuts off contact, they get to be judge and jury. The parent has no appeal, really. You write that the adult child cutting contact is always right and righteous. Where does that presumption come from, particularly when these are often the folks who talk about condemning moral absolutism, Noelle?
That's right. It really is an averted sort of its own authoritarianism. So that's rife throughout the movement is subcultures will say, you know, you can never question adult child's decision to go no contact. It's sort of an infallibility narrative that they're given, and it really gives cover. It mirrors other things we've seen in the culture, for example, during the Me Too movement when it was believe all women, as though, you know, just purely by status of being a victim, you have empirical authority or epistemic authority. I think we all know in our personal lives, it's just not true. Suffering can just as easily obscure reality as it can illuminate it. And so we all need to be checked. We all need to be corrected and course corrected and open to ways in which we might be able to see things differently. But there's a real tendency to black and white thinking here. My fact of my claiming harm is a validation of all my prudential decisions from here on out. That's just not a healthy way to look at any problem.
Mm-hmm. There's a sub-phenomena that I've been reading about. You call it the pissed off parent pushback. These are mothers on TikTok calling their estranged children ungrateful little B-words. Noelle, you say that response, however, understandable, is also wrong. Why?
Problem with identity politics, it always provokes a reaction. I think we're seeing this across all sorts of identitarian divides, where if one group claims sort of this authority and black and white thinking long enough, eventually the group that is being told to shut up and be quiet and be silenced is going to do it back to them and claim the victimhood status themselves. And so, yeah, there's a movement where parents are saying, you know, talking derisively about their kids now, and they want to start their own movement and they're angry and, you know, I think, you know, it's understandable, but it's not effective, nor is it healthy. We always have to be non-reactionary. We need to look at things, strive to look at with reality, not born out of emotion, but out of, you know, self-governance of the way we respond to things. So I encourage parents to kind of look at it as truthfully as they can, but not be kind of ruled by their emotions, even if it is in some ways a justifiable and understandable emotion, that we cannot become the pissed off parents. That actually just creates another swing of the pendulum. We keep battling each other back and forth. Someone needs to step out of that cycle. And I do think it is becoming for parents as sort of the call in their call to moral nobility and moral authority as shepherds to be the ones who take the higher road, not the weak road, but the higher road.
Well, I'm thinking of the prodigal son, you know, that father. And it's hard to be that father after you've been beaten up or your kids have cut you off. But maybe we have to show that gratuitous love and hope that that somehow breaks through. Particularly, everything we're talking about today is really about dividing the family. And the family is a battleground. And the fact that this stuff gets curry on social media and becomes a phenomenon is deeply disturbing. And I think has the mark of the satanic about it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It very much is following sort of a diabolical sort of thinking. And I think that you're right, that, you know, we have to kind of see the nihilism that's underneath it and reject it entirely. I do think that this is ultimately a spiritual battle. There are natural ways that we can talk about this and talk to people who are not religious about to help them see kind of the harm of it, you know, to our civic life, but also to our religious life. And to our future unity. But ultimately, foundationally, as people of prayer, we need to be leading utterly in that realm, that we need to be seeing this for what it is and not, like you said, the prodigal father, not being reactionary, not chasing after. He didn't chase after his son. He wasn't desperate. He tended to his duties, but he was open and ready to receive him and give that inheritance back to his son as soon as there was a turn. And so I think that posture, the prodigal father, is really the greatest model we have here. He wasn't calculating, nor was he passive, but he was waiting and he was prepared.
I want to turn to something a little more hopeful, Noel, because I don't want to upset everybody, including myself. There's a wave of young adults coming into the Catholic Church, and in a piece entitled "What Young Converts Are Really Looking For," you open with something a young convert told you, that the difference between non-denominational churches and the Catholic Church was this. In one, the dads want to be young and cool, and in the other, the dads are striving to be men. Now, Noel, I know there's a crisis of masculinity in the culture today. Is that what we're seeing driving the young people to tradition, particularly young men?
I really think that that's a piece of it, and a pretty compelling piece. And I think, you know, the message that you are enough, you know, affirm you where you are, if that's not a message that ultimately is going to resonate in a very purposeful way, especially for men who really want to be challenged, who want to be drawn out of themselves, women as well, you know, that nobody really values something that they don't have to really struggle for in any way. And I think the faith is a bit like that, that we are called to be, that we have dignity just where we are, but we are also called, invited into, you know, a path of holiness, of virtue, that we are, you know, not supposed to stay mired in our sin, but we are to struggle against our sin. And I think, you know, the church has that message very deeply. And I was very struck by this young man who's very insightful. He said, you know, that he had spent a long time in these non-denominational churches. And this is not to castigate all non-denominational churches. It was just his experience, but that there really was a sense that they were just cool guys. And what the Catholic men that he met, the ones that were really on fire and in love with our Lord, you know, they were eager to be the best fathers, to be the best leaders, to be the best husbands that they could possibly be. So there's this real striving after holiness. And that appealed to him. And I think that that is significant and appealing to a lot of young men in the country.
Noel, thank you so much. We will leave it there. No Contact, How a Seductive Ideology Broke Families and Friendships by Noel Mehring will be released this September from Forum Books at Pangram Random House. Thank you for being here. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. I know.